The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Armin Kasabian, and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
The U.S. government has approved the first long-acting drug combination treatment for HIV, the virus responsible for the disease AIDS. The treatment was approved by the Food and Drug Administration last week. It involves monthly injections to replace daily pills now used to control HIV. HIV is a virus that is spread through body fluids. Sexual contact can spread the disease, but so can infected blood and blood products. The two-injection combination treatment is called Cabenuva. The drug is expected to make it easier for people to receive their HIV medicines and to do so with more privacy. The injections mark a big change from methods used in the past. Those treatments required patients to take multiple pills several times a day, carefully timed around meals. Dr. Stephen Deeks is an HIV specialist at the University of California, San Francisco. He told the Associated Press that the new treatment can make patients' lives better because it is only needed once a month. People don't want those daily reminders that they're HIV infected, Deeks said. Cabenuva contains rilpivirine, which is sold as Edurant by Janssen, a company owned by Johnson & Johnson. It also contains a new drug called cabotegravir. It is made by Vive Healthcare. The two are sold together and given as separate injections once a month. The drug is also being tested for use every 2 months. The FDA approved Cabenuva for use in adults who have had their disease controlled by other HIV medicines and have not shown signs of viral resistance to the two drugs in Cabenuva. The agency also approved a pill version of cabotegravir to be taken with rilpivirine for 1 month to ensure the drugs do not cause bad effects. Vive said the injection combination would cost $5,940 for a higher first dose. The cost would then drop to $3,960 each month. The company said this price was similar to what one-a-day pill combinations cost now. How much each patient pays depends on their insurance, income, and other things. Dr. Judith Currier is an HIV specialist at the University of California, Los Angeles. She said studies on the new treatment found that patients greatly favored the injections. Even people who are taking one pill once a day just reported improvement in their quality of life to switch to an injection, she said. Currier is an advisor to Vive and wrote a commentary about one study on the drug in the New England Journal of Medicine. Deeks said long-acting injections also give hope of reaching groups that have a hard time carrying out daily treatment. He said that includes people with mental illness or substance abuse problems. There's a great unmet need that the injections may fill, he added. I'm Brian Lynn.
The warm coast of California is a place where many western monarch butterflies stay during the cold winter months in the United States. Researchers fear the record low number of monarchs this year could mean the insects are in danger of disappearing in the near future. Researchers from the Circe Society said they found fewer than 2,000 orange and black butterflies in the yearly count this January. That number showed a big drop from the tens of thousands in recent years. In the 1980s, there were millions of them in trees from Northern California's Marin County to San Diego County near the Mexico border. Every winter, western monarch butterflies fly south from the northwestern U.S. to California, going to the same places and even the same trees. At the start of November, they usually arrive in California. The insects then spread across the country once warmer weather arrives in March. On the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains, another monarch butterfly population travels from southern Canada and the northeastern United States to spend the winter in Mexico. Scientists estimate the eastern monarch population has decreased by 80% since the mid-1990s. But the decrease in the western monarch population has been much greater. The Circe Society works on conservation efforts for insects. Last winter, it recorded around 29,000 butterflies in its yearly survey. That was similar to the winter before, when an all-time low of 27,000 monarchs were counted. But the count this year is dangerously low. Pacific Grove is a city known for having monarch butterflies during the cold season. But volunteers did not see a single one this winter. Other well-known areas such as Pismo State Beach, Monarch Butterfly Grove, and Natural Bridges State Park only had a few hundred butterflies, researchers said. Scientists say there are several causes for the extremely low numbers of butterflies in the western states. Home building and chemical use have destroyed milkweed plants along their migratory path. The plants are needed for monarch butterflies to grow and develop. Climate change interferes with the growth of wild plants. And huge wildfires in the West may also have influenced their migration. Last December, U.S. federal officials said the monarch butterfly is a candidate for the threatened or endangered species list. The designation would provide protection for their food supply and environment, including their migratory path. However, they said no action would be taken for several years because many other species are still awaiting that designation. I'm Armin Kasabian.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. The coronavirus pandemic shows no signs of slowing down in many places around the world. So many people who usually work in offices continue to work from home. For some of them, working remotely may be something that will continue even after the pandemic ends. But working from home often requires different skills and ways of managing our work. So it is important to learn ways to help us work productively in a remote environment. VOA Learning English recently spoke with Natasha Olinger, a human resources expert. For 15 years, Olinger has managed human resources for several organizations in Washington, D.C. Olinger shares skills she says are most important during the pandemic, and possibly after. Working from home means you need good technical skills, Olinger notes. Without an IT department close by, employees need to know how to fix video, phone, or computer issues that come up. In other words, we need to be tech savvy.
You might need to be more technologically savvy now than you really have ever had to be, possibly because, you know, you worked in an office with an IT person or whatever it is. Not only is that important right now, but that's going to be important post-pandemic.
Technical skills are also called hard skills. However, to Olinger, they are not the most important skills to have when working remotely. She says soft skills are more important.
The other thing that I think is really important in the pandemic and is going to be important post-pandemic, really soft skills. And I think that doesn't necessarily get talked about a lot.
Soft skills, experts explain, are not about the knowledge you have. Instead, they control how you act in different situations, both on your own and with others. When dealing with other people, soft skills are sometimes called interpersonal skills. Communicating clearly, working well with others, and supporting your coworkers are examples of other soft skills. Experts at the employment company Indeed talked with 1,000 hiring managers. When asked to name the most important soft skills of their top performing employees, the managers listed these 5 soft skills: problem solving, effective communication skills, self-direction, being able to work effectively on your own, drive, a strong natural desire to do well, adaptability, flexibility, the ability to work well in changing situations. Soft skills are part of a person's EQ, or emotional quotient. While IQ is a measure of a person's intelligence quotient, EQ is a measure of a person's emotional intelligence. Soft skills, Olinger explains, are harder to learn than technical skills. Also, there are not as many resources teaching soft skills.
They call that ability to read people EQ, or it's emotional intelligence instead of IQ. But they certainly study it. But yeah, there's not sort of that, you know, this plethora of online classes. available to teach people this kind of thing.
Even an expert such as Olinger ran into trouble. In the early days of the pandemic, she held many meetings with groups of people over the phone. This is when Olinger noticed one of her soft skills was weak. She was unsure if she was communicating clearly. Without seeing the people and their visual cues, a nod of the head to show they understand, or a look of confusion on their face, she could not tell if her meetings were effective. So she decided to work on her own soft skills.
It's not only crucial to build those soft skills because I don't have that in-person connection anymore, but it's also more important than ever because people need those soft skills right now.
Olinger says that during the pandemic, managers have been able to see how employees with strong soft skills help the organization. She calls soft skills the glue that holds everything together. That means they are what keep the people in the workplace connected and able to work together. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Steve Ember and Shirley Griffith talk about Calvin Coolidge and how he became President of the United States.
The early 1920s were a troubled time for the United States. Congress and the public began to discover crimes by several officials in the administration of President Warren Harding. Harding himself became seriously sick during a trip to Alaska and western states. He died in a hotel room in California in August 1923. Harding's vice president, Calvin Coolidge, became the new president. Both men were Republicans. Their policies on issues were much the same. Coolidge, however, was a very different man. He was completely honest. He was the kind of president the country needed to rebuild public trust in the government.
Calvin Coolidge was quiet and plain-looking. He was the son of a farmer and political leader from the small northeastern state of Vermont. Young Calvin worked at different jobs to pay for his college education. He became a lawyer. He moved to another northeastern state, Massachusetts, where he became active in Republican Party politics. First, he was elected mayor of the town. Then he was elected to the state legislature. Finally, he was elected governor of Massachusetts. It was as governor that Coolidge first became known throughout the United States.
In 1919, a group of policemen in the city of Boston tried to start a labor union. This violated the rules of the police department. So the commissioner of police suspended 19 of the union's leaders. The next day, almost 75% of Boston's policemen went on strike. Criminals walked freely through the city for 2 nights. They robbed stores and threatened public safety. Frightened Americans all across the country waited to see what Governor Coolidge would do.
He took strong action. He called on state troops to end the strike. He said, "There is no right to strike against the public safety by anybody, anywhere, anytime." most Americans approved of what Coolidge did. The people of Massachusetts supported him, too. They re-elected him governor by a large number of votes. Then, in 1920, Republicans nominated Warren Harding for president. They nominated Calvin Coolidge for vice president. When President Harding died in California, Coolidge, his wife, and two sons moved to the White House.
America's 30th president was, in some ways, an unusual kind of person to lead the country. He said little. He showed few feelings. Coolidge's policies as president were not active. He tried to start as few new programs as possible. He was a conservative Republican who believed deeply that government should be small. Coolidge expressed his belief this way: if the federal government should go out of existence, most people would not note the difference. And once, he said, 4/5 of our troubles in this life would disappear if we would only sit down and keep still.
Coolidge believed that private business, not the federal government, should lead the country to greater wealth and happiness. He continued President Harding's policy of supporting American business both inside the United States and in other countries. The government under President Coolidge continued high taxes on imports in an effort to help American companies.
Many Americans shared Coolidge's ideas about small government and big business. In the early 1920s, many of them were living better than ever before. At that time, companies were growing larger. The prices of their stocks rose higher and higher. There were lots of jobs, and the wages of many workers increased. Americans agreed with their president that there was little need for government spending and government programs when private industry seemed so strong.
The American economy grew in the 1920s for several reasons. The World War had destroyed many factories and businesses in Europe. The United States did not suffer the same destruction. It was still a young country. It had great natural resources, trained workers, and a huge market within its own borders. When peace came, Americans found their economy stronger than any other in the world.
Changes in the American market also helped economic growth. Installment buying became popular. In this system, people could buy a product and pay for it over a period of several weeks or months. The total cost was higher because they had to pay interest. But the system made it possible for more people to buy more goods. It also made the idea of borrowing money more acceptable to many Americans.
The growing importance of the New York stock markets also helped economic growth in the 1920s. Millions of Americans bought shares of stock in companies that seemed to grow bigger every month. Such investment almost became a national game. People would buy shares of stock, then sell them when the stock rose in value. There were many stories of poor people who became rich overnight by buying the right stocks. The American Congress also helped the economy by lowering income taxes. People had more money to spend on new goods. Another important reason for economic growth was a change in the way American companies were operated.
During the 1920s, the idea of manufacturing goods in the most scientific way became very popular. The father of this idea of scientific management was an engineer, Frederick Taylor. Mr. Taylor developed a system to study manufacturing. He studied each machine involved in the process. He studied how much work each person did. He studied how goods moved from one part of a factory to another. Then he offered ideas to business owners about ways to produce goods faster and for less cost.
Taylor's ideas of scientific management appealed to business owners. Automobile manufacturer Henry Ford proved that the ideas could work in his new car factory in the state of Michigan. Ford used the assembly line system of production. In this system, each worker did one thing to a product as it moved through the factory. This helped cut prices and increase wages.
Ford and other businessmen learned a great deal about how to control costs, set prices, and decide how much to produce. All these changes in production and marketing helped Ford and other American companies grow larger and stronger. Henry Ford's Model T car became popular throughout the country. So did other new products, radios, refrigerators for cooling food, vacuums to clean carpets, ready-made cigarettes, beauty products. Americans in the 1920s began to buy all kinds of new products they had never used before.
Calvin Coolidge was in the White House. However, business led the nation. Times were good. Americans trusted business and its leaders. It became an honor to call someone a businessman. Colleges organized business classes. Middle-class citizens in almost every city and town gathered to discuss business ideas. President Coolidge spoke for millions of Americans when he said, "The chief business of the American people is business."
Coolidge represented traditional values and a simple way of life. He knew exactly how every dollar he earned was saved or spent, and he spent no more money than was necessary. The strange thing was that Coolidge was extremely popular with a public that was spending large amounts of money. Some economic experts warned that the country's quick economic growth would end in economic depression. Most Americans, however, believed that the good times had come to stay. They enjoyed the good things in life that work and success in business could bring. On our next program, we will see how the economic growth of the 1920s brought exciting changes to the day-to-day life of millions of Americans.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.